You're listening to Decisive Point. The views and opinions expressed in this podcast are those of the authors and are not necessarily those of the Department of the Army, the U.S. Army War College, or any other agency of the U.S. government. Dr. Jeffrey H. Michaels is joining me virtually today from Barcelona, Spain, to discuss his article, Rethinking the Relevance of Self-Deterrence, which you can find in the spring 2024 issue of Perimeters. Michaels is the IEN Senior Fellow in American Foreign Policy and International Security at the Barcelona Institute for International Studies. He's the co-author with Sir Lawrence Friedman of The Evolution of Nuclear Strategy, New, Updated, and Completely Revised, published in 2019. Thank you for joining me today, Jeffrey.
Oh, thank you so much for the invitation.
You know in your article that deterrence is most discussed in terms of deterring others. What is self-deterrence?
We often think about deterrence as actor A deterring actor B. Self-deterrence is basically actor B deterring actor B. So when we think about a common definition of deterrence, it's the persuasion of one's opponent that the costs and or risks of taking a certain course of action will outweigh the benefits. Now, in self-deterrence, it's basically one actor actually saying, you know what, the costs of taking this action far outweigh the benefits. When an adversary is threatening, there are a number of other reasons, a number of other consequences that are in the minds of decision makers of that state. So, for example, common definition of self-deterrence stresses reputational concerns. So things like moral and ethical reasons why a state wouldn't want to take a certain course of action. So there's one school of thought that focuses on reputational concerns, and this is things like moral and ethical reasons why not to take certain courses of action. There's another school that talks about exaggerated beliefs about an adversary's capabilities or intentions. So in other words, you can have certain fantasies in your own head about what an adversary is able or capable or planning to do, but then there are a whole set of other concerns. For example, if you're invading another country, you might not be concerned about actually taking over the country, as in defeating the enemy army, but you could have a very significant concern about having to occupy the country afterwards. Then there are also a whole bunch of other things, for example, that the adversary has no control over whatsoever. So you might think about various international audiences or domestic audiences, neutral countries that you don't want to alienate, and so forth. And then there are other things as well, like you might be concerned about being deterred in the short term, or not being deterred in the short term, but being deterred because of the longer-term implications. So for instance, it might be catastrophic success. You achieve your short-term goal, but actually, you know that's going to cause all sorts of problems in the long term. So again, this is a bit different from traditional notions of deterrence.
Many scholars associate self-deterrence with nuclear weapons. You claim self-deterrence predates 1945. Tell me more.
Yes, for a very simple reason, which is that deterrence precedes 1945 as well. If deterrence precedes it, then self-deterrence automatically precedes it as well. When we think about deterrence as an academic subject, we tend to associate it, as you said, with nuclear weapons. However, deterrence as a fact of life has preceded it, going back to the very beginning of time, one could say. We often talk about deterrence as starting in the Garden of Eden, and the first deterrence failure was God not successfully deterring Adam from eating the apple, and so forth. But self-deterrence, like deterrence, goes back a very long way. And you can see evidence of this in history. So when we look at things like how decision makers actually think about going to war, for example, or using certain weapons, in the article, I don't go that far back, but I go to the debates about chemical weapons use during the First World War and the aftermath of the First World War, and especially in the lead up to the Second World War and during the course of the Second World War. So one can find any number of examples throughout history. But I think one of the key problems is that with so much of the discourse on deterrence, people automatically associate it with nuclear weapons, but actually can be associated with any subject under the sun, effectively. But that's certainly the case with conventional wars and so on.
How can policymakers be deterred from taking military action, not by fear, but by considering other consequences that don't fit into the traditional understanding of deterrence?
If you think, for example, about, say, the Cuban Missile Crisis, which is a very commonly referred to case, and you ask the question, well, why didn't Kennedy order a military invasion of Cuba, or even to attack it militarily with airstrikes? And one of the common reasons given for why he did not do this, and one that he gave himself effectively, was that he was concerned that if the U.S. attacks Cuba, then the Soviets will attack and capture West Berlin. What's interesting about that case specifically is that the Soviets never threatened to attack West Berlin. This was an assumption on his part. This is what he thinks that they might do, but it wasn't necessarily something that the Soviets actually threatened to do. So that just gives you one example of how a policymaker can actually think of something and project his own ideas about what an adversary will do, and then having the self-deterring effect.
Do you have any concluding thoughts you'd like to share about this topic?
One of the key things that has interested me a great deal, and one reason why I wrote this article, actually two reasons. One was that I've noticed that in the literature, there's very little about self-deterrence. To the extent that there's been any discussion of the topic amongst deterrence theorists, they rarely ever go beyond a few pages in discussing it, and they don't really examine it in any meaningful way. To the extent that they do, it's usually only limited to this one example of reputational concerns. They don't really go into the issues of exaggerated beliefs, much less the whole issue of catastrophic success and so on and so forth. I think that there's a great need to actually go into this topic in much greater depth. And what I was hoping to do with the article was at least to tempt some other analysts to pay a bit more attention to it and get a debate started. The second reason is that I think that when it comes to things like strategy, how we think about adversaries, as well as how adversaries think about us, this issue of how we limit our own actions is actually quite important, as well as how adversaries limit their own actions. What actually leads the other side's decision makers not to take certain types of actions? How can you exaggerate those fears? I've noticed over the years that one typical way of discussing deterrence, especially from a military perspective, is always thinking about, well, we have capability X, and if we have enough of capability X, whatever that is, that'll be enough to deter the adversary. But that's really more about our capabilities, hoping that that actually is what they fear. And so it's a lot less about what is it that they actually fear. It might have nothing to do with our capabilities whatsoever. Maybe it does, maybe it doesn't, but maybe there are also fears you can actually exaggerate through psychological means and other means to manipulate their behavior.
I'm curious, is there something going on internationally or even locally that makes this especially relevant right now?
Yes, there are quite a few cases, actually. When we think about why has Russia not used nuclear weapons in Ukraine, for example, or even chemical weapons or something like this, one could make the argument that they have been deterred by Western threats. Now, I don't personally believe this because I don't think that the threats have been terribly convincing. To some extent, for example, they've talked about conventional retaliation or something like this. You could also see it in terms of, well, could it be that they're worried about what the Chinese might do because the Chinese oppose their using nuclear weapons? Or maybe they're worried about opening Pandora's box. This was the problem that Colin Powell famously talked about, letting the genie loose from the bottle back at the time of the first Gulf War. If you use nuclear weapons in that war, then, you know, somebody else is going to use them, you know, a month later or a year later or something like this. So there are all sorts of fears like that that I think are quite relevant to the present time. And likewise, for example, when we talk about scenarios of, say, a Chinese invasion of Taiwan, what is it that's actually holding them back? Is it the United States? Is it the Taiwanese? Is it something else? So trying to get a sense of what is sort of the full scope of those fears is quite essential. But I tend to find that in the policy discourse, we only tend to focus on a very narrow set of fears. Those fears, those sort of things that we can directly inflict upon an adversary, potentially not examining this full range of fears.
It was a pleasure talking with you today, Jeffrey. Thank you so much for making time for this.
No, my pleasure. Thank you so much.
Listeners, you can read the article at press.armywarcollege.edu/parameters. Look for Volume 54, Issue 1. For more Army War College podcasts, check out Conversations on Strategy, SSI Live, and A Better Peace.